content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the science section, and it is entitled, "Oh Great, Spiders Can Swim," by Amber Dance. Shrubbery, tool sheds, basements, these are places one might expect to find spiders. But what about the beach or in a stream? Some spiders make their homes near, or more rarely, in water, tucking into the base of kelp stalks, spinning watertight cocoons in ponds or lakes, hiding under pebbles at the seaside or along a creek bank. Spiders are surprisingly adaptable, which is one of the reasons they can inhabit this environment, says Zamina Nelson, a behavioral biologist at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand. Finding aquatic or semi-aquatic spiders is difficult work, Nelson says. She and a student have spent 4 years chasing a jumping spider known as Marpisa marina around the pebbly seaside beaches it likes. But too often, as soon as they manage to find one, it disappears under rocks. And sadly, some aquatic spiders may disappear altogether before they come to scientists' attention, as their watery habitats shrivel because of climate change and other human activities. What scientists do know is that dozens of described spider species spend at least some of their time in or near the water, and more almost surely awaiting discovery, says Sarah Cruz, an arachnologist at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. It also appears that spiders evolved aquatic preferences on several distinct occasions throughout the history of this arthropod order. Cruz and colleagues surveyed spiders and reported in 2019 that 21 taxonomic families are associated with aquatic habitats, suggesting that the evolutionary event occurred multiple independent times. Only a swashbuckling few, not even 0.3% of the described spider species, are seashore spiders. Many more have been found near fresh water, Nelson says. It's not clear what would induce successful land-dwelling critters to move to watery habitats. Spiders as a group probably evolved about 400 million years ago from chunkier creatures that had recently left the water. These arthropods lack the skinny waist supported by modern spiders. Presumably, the spiders that later returned to a life aquatic were strongly drawn by something to eat there, or driven by unsafe conditions on land, says Gerard Vermige, a paleobiologist and distinguished professor at UC Davis, because water would have presented major structural or major survival challenges. Since they depend on air so much, they are severely limited in whether they can do anything at all when they are submerged, other than just toughing it out, Vermige says. Newly aquatic spiders would have had to compete with predators better adapted to watery conditions, such as crustaceans, with competition particularly fierce in the oceans, Vermige says. And if water floods a spider's air circulation system, it will die. So adaptations were obviously needed. But spiders as a group already possess several water-friendly features, Cruz suggests. They have waxy, water-repellent exteriors, often covered in hairs that conveniently trap air bubbles. Even having eight legs is helpful, Nelson says. Spiders can distribute their weight nicely while they skitter across a water surface, or use their octet of appendages to row along. Some spiders take their aquatic adaptations to the next level, though. Consider the diving bell spider, Argyroneta aquatica, an overachieving arachnid that is the only one known to do it all underwater, breathe, hunt, dine on insects and their larvae, and make spiderlings. Found in fresh water in Europe and parts of Asia, It spins a silken underwater canopy and brings air bubbles from the surface to its submerged home via its body hairs. When it goes out, it carries a smaller air bubble, like a little scuba tank, on its back. Seashore spiders face particularly daunting conditions, says Nelson, who co-authored an article about adaptations of marine spiders for the 2024 Annual Review of Entomology. There's a splash zone, she says. It's kind of a wild environment. A spider might be baking in the hot sun one minute and drenched in chilly salt water the next. Some spiders migrate up and down their beaches with the tides. Nelson speculates that they monitor lunar cycles to anticipate when to move. Other seashore spiders spin watertight nests where they hide out for hours while the tide is in. M. marina, for example, seeks seashells with nice concave spaces in which to spin safe tents. Another spider, Dias marina, hides in holdfasts where bull kelp attached to rocks, lining the holdfast interior with silk to create an air-filled pocket and staying submerged for as long as 19 days. D. marina emerges only when the tide is going out to hunt for invertebrates like shrimp. When a spider hides out with a limited air supply for days or weeks at a time, oxygen levels may become a crucial issue. Intriguingly, researchers have identified gene variants within the oxygen-guzzling, energy-making mitochondria of aquatic spiders that may help them cope with low-oxygen environments. These changes mirror beneficial changes to mitochondrial genes in birds that live in high-altitude, low-oxygen environments. In another study, researchers investigated the genes used in the silk glands of aquatic and land spiders. They found that water spider silk seems to have a high proportion of water-repelling amino acids, which might also be an adaptation, they suggest. But all the adaptations in the world might not be enough to save some watery spiders. Nelson's M. marina, for example, seems to be very particular about the beaches it occupies. The pebbles must be just right, not too big or small. If the sea level rise inundates the beaches, it's possible the spiders will have nowhere else to go, Nelson says, so those spiders will be lost. Marco Isaiah, an arachnologist at the University of Turin in Italy, investigated the wetland habitats of the diving bell spider and the fen raft spider, Dolomedes plantarius. As wetlands continue to disappear, the inhabitants available to each species will contract by more than 25% over a decade, and their ideal ranges will move northward, Isaiah and colleagues predicted in a 2022 study. It would be difficult for spiders to cross dry land for new wetlands, and North European winters might prove too cold anyway. The loss and degradation of wetland habitats is expected to have serious impacts on their survival, Isaiah says, and an increase in their extinction risk. Given these risks, some aquatic spiders might go the way of the dodo before science gets a handle on them. I suspect in every rocky bed of beach or river, there are probably spiders that we just don't know exist there, Nelson says, because they're hiding. Second, a technology article. EVs could last nearly forever if car companies let them, by Mateo Wong. In April, a group of people in a red Tesla driving through the Moroccan desert were glued to the odometer on the car's giant touchscreen. 2 million Hans? 2 million, exclaimed the front seat passenger to the owner and driver, Hans-Jörg von Gemmingen-Hornberg. His 2014 Model S had become likely the first electric vehicle to drive 2 million kilometers, or more than 1.2 million miles. The car could have traveled from the Earth to the Moon and back twice, then circled the equator 11 times. The journey wasn't entirely seamless. The car has had its share of repairs, including several battery and motor replacements. A handful of gas-powered cars have driven farther. Most of all, a 1966 Volvo that racked up some 3 million miles over five decades. But such fantastic mileages are becoming far easier to accomplish for ordinary commuters with electric cars. On a technological level, it's possible that we're not far from a time when nobody would flinch at an EV with as much mileage as von Geminger-Hornberg's, that is, unless car companies themselves get in the way. Unlike gas-powered engines, which are made up of thousands of parts that shift against one another, a typical EV has only a few dozen moving parts. That means less damage and maintenance, making it easier and cheaper to keep a car on the road well past the approximately 200,000-mile range average lifespan of a gas-powered vehicle. And EVs are only getting better. There are certain technologies that are coming down the pipeline that will get us toward that million-mile EV, Scott Mora, a civil and environmental engineer at UC Berkeley, told me. That many miles would cover the average American driver for 74 years. The first EV you buy could be the last car you ever need to purchase. Gas cars are already astonishingly durable. In theory, they can just keep getting repaired. That's how you get classic cars. But after they get to be about 12 to 15 years old, major problems such as a shot engine or a broken transmission are frequently not worth the cost of repair. Even without problems, a newer car is likely to have much better gas mileage than an older one, making a trade-in appealing. EVs are still so new that few of them are a decade old, meaning that we have yet to figure out the exact limit of their lifespan. The ones that do exist give us some sense. Several older Teslas and Nissan Leafs have topped 300,000 miles, as did the first three batteries in von Geminger-Hornberg's million-miler. His first Tesla, a Roadster purchased in 2009, has itself traveled more than 400,000 miles. The biggest factor in EV longevity is the batteries. Just like those in a smartphone, they degrade over time. A battery might lose 1 or 2% of its maximum range each year, depending on how it is charged and used, meaning that after 15 years, a car's range might have slipped from 300 miles to 210 miles per charge. Repairing a car's battery is difficult, if not impossible. And replacements are expensive, Ed Kim, the chief analyst at the consulting firm Auto Pacifica, told me. Many EV warranties today will cover replacements to a battery for either 8 years or 100,000 miles of driving, and they are considered due for replacement once they've dipped below 70% of their initial capacity, according to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Batteries today are expected to take far longer to lose that much of their maximum charge, potentially 300,000 miles, or about 15 to 20 years. The lifespan should only improve. Batteries are one of the most active areas in EV development, Kim said. Prices are plummeting, which will make battery replacement more feasible, and the range of the new EV batteries keeps going up. Longevity will also benefit. Some EV batteries, including the one in the Tesla Model 3 standard range, can already last for some 500,000 miles on the road, Mora said. One Chinese manufacturer recently announced a battery warranted for nearly 1 million miles. And even more durable battery designs, Mora said, are in the works. A researcher at Tesla has tested a battery that he claims could drive for 4 million miles, or roughly 100 years, under the right conditions. Of course, how long a car can keep running is not necessarily the same as how long somebody wants to drive it. EVs are more high-tech than gas cars, and standard improvements, longer range, faster charging, a better touchscreen, and infotainment system, improved autopilot features, would compel people to buy new models, just as they do for any tech gadget today. But at some point, Each successful model will not be all that much better than the last. Do I need a slightly better sensor so that the windshield wipers work better when it rains, as Lauren McDonald, an EV consultant, put it to me? Maybe I don't. With continued battery improvements, more drivers may opt to stick with an older car rather than buy a new one. A decade-old EV that can go 400 miles on a single charge instead of its initial 500 miles will be more than sufficient for most drivers. The longevity of EVs and any appetite for new cars might help address one of the primary complaints with these cars, that their sticker prices are too high for the typical American household. Used cars, which will continue to work well while requiring fewer repairs, will open up the EV revolution to much of the country. A used Tesla can already be purchased for roughly $20,000. We have to think about how we design these vehicles, not for the first owner, but for the third, the fourth, the fifth owner, Mora said. Even if many people are content with driving the same EV for decades, car companies may try to stop them. Tesla, Ford, and other auto manufacturers will need people to buy new EVs and may well create incentives for us to do so. In the EV age, car companies are acting more like tech companies and bringing more software to their cars than ever before. The entire auto industry could follow an adoption and replacement cycle, a lot like that of the iPhone. Now, the iPhone 15 isn't that different from the iPhone 11, but people do, of course, constantly buy new phones from Apple. The old ones are expensive or difficult to repair, and with every software update seem to slow down just a bit. Whereas Apple commands a ton of brand loyalty and a dominant hold on smartphone sales, causing a car's battery or motor to degrade faster is a great strategy for losing customers. Carmakers' approach may not resemble planned obsolescence so much as planned improvements, McDonald said, making older hardware incompatible with software updates or other new functions. Car companies may be able to ensnare people in the software and gadget ecosystems, just as Apple does, as Ford, GM, Tesla, and other auto manufacturers sell home charging systems and other energy products, car owners might have to upgrade their vehicles to keep up. The bigger concern is that some battles over the right to repair an iPhone are also coming to cars. Even though EVs require fewer repairs, they aren't maintenance-free. And right now, most EV repairs can be done only by the manufacturers and their retailers. Any mechanic can fix pretty much any traditional car, but EVs require specialized parts and training that are hard to come by. Tesla has already faced multiple class action antitrust lawsuits alleging the company maintains an unlawful monopoly over maintenance and repair parts. What I foresee is that with newer vehicles, the ability for an individual to repair it themselves is becoming less, Morris said. Longevity is not just a bonus to EVs, it's central to their promise. Cars that spend more years on the road mean less carbon from the manufacturing process, less mining for battery minerals, and less scrap metal. More used vehicles that cycle through more owners will mean the same. If car companies continue to act more like tech companies as their products become more like tech gadgets, an entire avenue of their green potential could be closed off. Next, Why It's Nice to Know You by Arthur C. Brooks. My sorrow, I could not awaken, my heart to joy at the same tone, and all I'd loved alone. These lines come from the American writer Edgar Allan Poe's poem Alone, written in 1829. The poem laments his intense, painful loneliness. His isolation is perhaps self-imposed. Some evidence suggests to me that Poe may have lacked interest in others. According to one obituary, Poe had very few friends, and he was the friend of a very few, if any. Do you feel a longing to be known that is not being met? If so, then, in that, at least, you are not alone. According to a survey conducted by the health services company Cigna and the market research company Ipsos in 2018, more than half of U.S. adults said they are always or sometimes felt that no one knows them well. If this includes you, you may be suffering from what we call, could call, Poe syndrome, in which your inattention to others is the root of the problem. Great deal of research has demonstrated that feeling known by others brings a higher well-being. For example, one study in 2008 showed that when measuring life satisfaction on a 1 to 7 scale, simply feeling more understood on a given day pushed up satisfaction by nearly half a point. The scholars also noticed significant gender differences. For instance, when women felt misunderstood, their life satisfaction fell by about 3 times more than men's. Neuroscientists have explored the effects of being known and understood. Using fMRI technology, they have found that feeling understood activates pleasure centers in the brain, while feeling misunderstood stimulates pain centers. This feeling makes evolutionary sense insofar as we tend to succeed better in close communities when others know and understand us, and we are more under threat of rejection when we don't have that understanding from others. So even in modern times, when no one knows you well, or your partner seems to not understand you, your brain may send out an alarm that corresponds to the ancient warning that you might soon be wandering the savannah alone. We tend to thrive more by being known than we do by knowing others. For example, scholars found that knowledge of one's spouse improved adjustment to marriage, enhanced intimacy, and increased trust. However, being known by your spouse improved all three measures of marital happiness by about twice as much. Interestingly, research shows that for straight men and women, knowing that their partner is trying to understand them is even more important than that they actually succeed in doing so. And this perspective is more strongly tied to relationship satisfaction for women. The asymmetry between wanting to know others and being known by them presents an inherent problem because relationships require reciprocity. If I don't do the work to know you deeply, a relationship doesn't form in which you will know me. This vicious cycle, Poe syndrome again, is made much worse when you are lonely to begin with. Researchers have demonstrated that loneliness can lead to self-centeredness. In other words, if no one knows you well and you are thus lonely, that may make you more self-focused and less interested in others, making it much less likely for others to want to get to know you well. To begin to be truly known by others involves breaking out of Poe syndrome by proactively knowing them. This is one of the great secrets of socially successful people, such as politicians. For example, former President Bill Clinton was famous for making whomever he was talking to feel completely seen and understood. As one observer put it, he has the ability to connect with an audience and then turn around and make the person who was helping with the slideshow feel like they're the most important person there. This trait does not come naturally to many of us, though, as the writer David Brooks, who is a friend but no relation, notes in his recent book, How to Know a Person. He observes that a lot of people are diminishers, self-involved to the point that others feel small and unseen. Such diminishers do this by speaking primarily about themselves, something that studies show most people do often, and by failing to ask questions. Brooks contrasts diminishers with illuminators, who are persistently curious about others, ask questions, and listen to the answers. Being curious about others and asking genuine questions have strongly positive effects. For example, as my Harvard colleague Allison Wood Brooks and her co-authors have shown, asking a lot of questions on a first date will make you 9% more likable. If you ask follow-up questions, which demonstrate even deeper interest in the other person, the odds that you'll get a second date improve. Follow-up questions demand actively listening to the other person, a practice essential to knowing them. In other words, you must pay attention to what they tell you, with an intent to learn from it. That contrasts with how we often listen during conversations, especially in academic settings. We're waiting to talk. Real listening requires being truly present and mindful when you are engaged with the other person, offering the gift of your whole self, undistracted by other matters or, God forbid, your devices. Research suggests that this combination of active listening and mindfulness is central to the relationship quality. So avoiding Poe syndrome in your life is remarkably simple. When you talk with others, remember this string of actions. Focus completely on the person. Ask plenty of genuine questions about their life. Listen carefully to their answers. Ask thoughtful follow-up questions, and leave your phone in your pocket for the entire conversation. By showing genuine curiosity about a person in this way, you might get a second date, repair a frayed marriage, or start a good friendship. You will also be on your way to being truly known yourself, which is what your heart most desires. And who knows what other benefits this ethic of knowing and being known might bring you? For me, the answer is this column writing. It's based each week on not bright ideas that spontaneously pop into my head, but on conversations I have with real people I meet at my university, on an airplane, or anywhere else a conversation strikes up. I ask people a lot of questions about their life and their happiness. Invariably, what they tell me only brings up more things I want answers to, an appetite I try to satisfy by going off to read a lot of research and writing about it all here. I'll never be a creative genius like Edgar Allan Poe, but knowing others works fine for me, and I'm a happier person to boot. The writer Arthur Brooks also has a podcast that he hosts called How to Build a Happy Life. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.